You are tuned in to a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. Join us now on another exciting metaphysical journey. Relax, tune in, drop out, and take a seat by the fire as we explore new realms and possibilities. This is Magenta Pixie. You can find me at magentapixie.weebly.com. But now, here is Zany Mystic and guest. Enjoy the show.
Greetings, and welcome to a Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. I'm your host, Lance White. Today, my guest is Steve Behrman. Steve is an internationally known author, humorist, and workshop leader. For the past 23 years, he has written and performed as Swami Beyondananda, the cosmic comic. Swami's comedy has been called irreverently uplifting and has been described both as comedy disguised as wisdom and wisdom disguised as comedy. As the Swami, Steve is the author of Driving Your Own Karma, When You See a Sacred Cow, Milk It for All It's Worth, Duck Soup for the Soul, and Swami for President, a seven-step plan to heal the body politic and cure erectile dysfunction. As Steve Behrman, he has recently co-authored a brilliant new book with Dr. Bruce Lipton called Spontaneous Evolution, Our Positive Future, and A Way to Get There from Here. So let's welcome Steve back to the show now. Hi, Steve. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. How about you?
I'm okay. It's a nice, beautiful day outside. So, yes, it's I'm doing all right.
Well,
I'm still working on your wonderful new book, and so far it's enlightening, funny, and solid science.
Well, that's good. It took Bruce and I 3.5 years to write it, so it's understandable if it takes you a little while to read it.
Well, I only have one complaint.
Yes. let's hear it.
It's just me. This is a silly story, but you know that picture of the old hag and that turns into the young woman?
That's right.
I never did see the young woman.
Ah.
I stared and stared and stared and stared at that thing, and I could not see her. So, you know, I think there's something wrong with me. I better go see my doctor.
Well, or maybe see a paradox.
Yeah, there you go. So what prompted you to co-author the book with Dr. Lipton?
I think we just basically got a message from the universe. I met Bruce about 5 years ago, and we just started a conversation, and we realized that we both had interests in spirituality, Bruce coming more from the science perspective, and coming uh-huh. more from the psychological perspective, and we realized that we had similar and intertwining views in relation to politics. And so we began this conversation, and I've always had this serious side to me. My background was in political science. I was involved in alternative education. I was a freelance writer and so on. And having really developed the Swami part of my personality, my multiple personality, and also really looking at these tremendously transformational times that we're living in right now, and we've seen a lot of political dysfunction. We've seen institutions that are not really that actually don't do what they're supposed to do. We have a healthcare system that's unhealthy and uncaring. You know, we have a banking system that my brother works for the Bankers Association, and the joke that's circulating around there is, remember the good old days when people robbed banks? So there's a lot of dysfunction going on, and there needed. I felt that I wanted to be able to use my expertise and so on to bring some light to that. And in having Bruce as a co-author in bringing his really brilliant science, we offer a foundational perspective for a new story that we are on the cusp of a spontaneous evolution, kind of like a spontaneous remission, where we emerge to a higher and more intelligent level of organization, and we have science pointing us the way that every phase of evolution, from the single cell organisms deciding that they don't want to be single anymore and becoming multi cell organisms, to organisms, aggregations of cells as complicated as you are or me, a community of 50 trillion cells. That's you and me and everybody listening. So every phase of evolution involves increased awareness and increased connection. And so if we extrapolate evolution out into the future, human evolution doesn't involve necessarily growing a bigger brain or, an extra limb or something like that. It really involves expanding awareness and community to the point of recognizing that we are each and all cells in a new superorganism called humanity. And if you begin to look at things from that perspective, the things that we see in our world that are not working right now, for example, the autoimmune dysfunction called warfare, where healthy cells are mobilized by manipulators against other healthy cells, and we end up spending our, half our resource to either destroy one another or to prevent somebody from destroying us, we can no longer afford to do this if we're going to survive as a species.
You give a vivid demonstration of this in the book, don't you, where you're talking about, you mentioned if the body did this and one of the cells, if we had cancer in the liver, what's that? Do you remember that analogy? It was really poignant.
Well, I think if we look at the political standpoint, if our body did what we did, let's say in responding to terrorism, one organ would declare war on another organ, and you never hear about the liver invading the pancreas, demanding the islets of Langerhans. It just doesn't happen. What the body does is it isolates the pathogens. So consequently, the body politic would want to isolate the sociopathogens, the forces in society that are out only for themselves and not for the benefit of anybody or everybody.
Absolutely.
So this is a new way of looking at the world, and then of course, what unfolds from that is, well, if we are in fact on the cusp of this evolution, why does everything seem to be falling apart? And another useful biological metaphor is the transformation of the caterpillar into the butterfly. And during that process, the caterpillar is deconstructing. It's this melting goo, and very confusing, I'm sure, to all the cells involved. But while the caterpillar is falling apart, these new cells, called imaginal cells, are beginning to communicate with one another and cluster together. And this seems to be what's happening right now, that there is a community of human cells. Paul Ray called this group the cultural creatives, now comprising about 30 to 35% of adult Americans, who recognize this new paradigm.
Well, it is recorded scientifically, too, even though we can't believe all science, because they're run also by grants and various other things. But it has been proven that humans remain stagnant for millions of years, and then they make an evolutionary jump, and then thousands of years later, there's the next leap, and it seems to be almost instantaneous.
The evolutionists call this punctuated equilibrium, where there's a steady plateau and then something happens. And usually in the past, what's happened has been some hurtling body from outer space that created such a cataclysm that the old species needed to either adapt immediately to new situations or die off. In fact, something very recently, there was once again that speculation that it was some meteorite that wiped out the dinosaurs. So at this point, though, it's not an object from, it's not debris from outer space that we are endangered by. It's the debris from inner space. It's our own beliefs, our own dysfunctional and obsolete beliefs in in the lowest common denominator, in the idea that might does make right, in the idea that only the physical world exists, as the current scientific paradigm suggests to us, and the belief that evolution is a random process, when in actuality evolution is an intelligent learning process engaged in by life.
Well, is it then important to see a connection between our own lives and the larger scale events that we see happening all over the world? In other words, as you said, we can't do something, what we're seeing outside is not something that's disassociated from us entirely. We have to be responsible for it, starting with going within, I would think, yes?
Well, yeah, and part of the part of what we talk about in the book is fractals, and fractals, to oversimplify, is simply representing the repeating patterns of nature, the self-similar repeating patterns of nature. So a simple example is if you look at an aerial view of a shoreline, the patterns, the way the shore goes in and out and so on, is very similar to looking at it from a looking at the ocean standing right there. So nature tends to repeat patterns over and over again. And so if we look at these self-similar patterns, we can see that the same things that hold true for being healthy or unhealthy for a cell are true for the individual, are true for the community, are true for humanity and for the planet. So if we begin to look at our look at the things that we do every day, the things that we use, how we spend our time, how we spend our money, what we put our attention on, and we begin to recognize not just the impact that these have on us short term, but the impact that they have on our bodies, ourselves, our communities, our children, their children, etc. The Native American people and most indigenous folks really looked at seven generations forward and seven generations backward, that an action that we have today, like a pebble that's dropped in the water, has a ripple effect going out, going backward seven generations and forward seven generations. So part of this is, number one, is to recognize the relationship between what we do and how we spend our time with the impact it's going to have. On a more positive note, it also gives us the opportunity to look at what our own personal gifts and talents and tendencies and skills and things that we love to do and missions and visions, and how to weave that with the larger picture, the larger evolving new organism called humanity.
You know, one of the things that I have a problem with routinely is getting hung up on the 3D world that I see with my five senses, and the enormous incongruities, such as genetically modified food. I think you mentioned Monsanto in the books briefly.
Yeah, a little section called Monsanto Clause is Coming to Town.
Would you like to talk a little bit about that, by the way?
Well, why don't you finish your thought, and then I'll probably speak to
and,
all of
and
that.
The rampant the theft that's going on by the Federal Reserve, which is neither federal nor a reserve, which is it's basically a gang of banksters taking over the political world and the structure, and the sucking the money out like a Hoover vacuum cleaner. So, you know, we see these things going on, and the effort to depose anybody that's positive that wants to try to change, and they get slaughtered and replaced by somebody that's corruptible and does bad things at our you know, request. So how do we begin to feel like there's some kind of personal power in rooting out this disease of psychopathy that you mentioned earlier?
Well, let's go back a little bit. I mean, first of all,
okay,
there's the truism that if you're doing something that doesn't work and you keep doing more of that something, then what doesn't work is going to not work even more than it doesn't work now. The insanity being, you know, continuing to do the same things and expect different results. So
right.
The institutions that we have in our society, the things that we've empowered mostly subconsciously through beliefs that we've inherited through even chemistry that gets passed down in our mother's womb, that is an indication. We get the first indications of what the world is going to be like while a fetus. And based on the mother's chemistry, based on whether her perceptions are saying the world is a friendly place out there or the world is a dangerous place out there, we make more hindbrain if we perceive that the world is going to be an unfriendly place. We make more frontal lobe, if we get the perceptions that the world is a friendlier place. So we have so much of our own unconscious programming caught up in the way that things used to be. You know, and the joke is, it's not very funny, but it's still a joke, that most human beings are operated by remote, by dead people. You know, that these old ways of thinking continue to control us. Now, it turns out that the four pillars of scientific materialism, which is the dominant paradigm that we've built all of our institutions on, the four pillars of scientific materialism have been inconveniently proved not true by science. The first I'm just going to go through these very briefly. The first is, we call it only matter matters, that scientific materialism, you know, religion notwithstanding, the dominant paradigm tells us that only the physical world exists. And as quantum physicists are discovering, it's actually the subatomic world is a world of energy, not matter. And what biologists are learning, that it's not the physical chemistry in the body is actually controlled by something not physical, our thoughts and beliefs. Yeah, a very, very simple example of that is the placebo effect, that when people believe that they've been given a medicine when they've really been given just a sugar pill, about one-third of those cases, the people get well anyway because they thought they got a treatment. So what's that about? It wasn't in the physical medication that they received, but it was in their thought and belief. So we're seeing that we have institutions that are built on these beliefs in money, that really money, materialism, and the machine should dominate because we live in a physical and not a spiritual world. We have this belief in what we call the lowest common denominator, survival of the fittest. And it turns out that environments evolve as whole systems. So it's not survival of the fittest, it's thrival of the fittingest. So we are actually, the reason why all of these institutions are not working and the reason why we have banks robbing people instead of the other way around is that these systems are built on false premises. They're not built on the way the universe actually works. They're built on an interpretation that's obsolete. We are in this transition time. We are in a time when the old beliefs, like the caterpillar, the old structures are falling apart. They're not really able, you know, they're not capable of answering the questions that we have. They're not capable of bringing us into this next millennium. And yeah, you can look at, you know, if you look at, for example, you know, the Obama administration, they're basically trying to fix the caterpillar. And the caterpillar is not fixable. It requires an entirely new paradigm, a new approach, a new way of doing things and seeing things. In nature, when populations reach certain densities, something shifts in the organization of that population. As an example, If you have one fish or two fish or three fish and you put them in a fish tank, they swim in a fairly random pattern. They swim around and so on. As you keep adding fish, at some point you will reach a threshold population where the fish are, the density of population is such that the structure, the way that the fish relate to one another changes, and they begin to swim in kind of a barrel motion, around, it's barrel motion. When more fish are added and they reach the next threshold, they begin to swim in a schooling pattern. So we human beings have gone, I don't know how much the, since when the population has doubled, but certainly in the past 50 years the population has doubled. And we're coming to the point where at the number of people that we have on the planet, there's required a different organizing principle. So, for example, if you're looking at single-cell organisms becoming multi-cell organisms, that was a breakthrough. But then a further breakthrough was required when the population density increased to the point where cells needed to specialize. So we are now at a point where the organizations, the institutions that we have instituted to determine how human beings relate to one another, they are obsolete. They are not applicable anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And we're in the point where the old is falling away and the new has yet to coalesce.
Mm. So it really is a crumbling of the old paradigm, and the new paradigm hasn't really clicked in yet, so to speak. In other words, there probably is some kind of moment or aha in the universe when, like the 100th monkey theory, that, once a certain percentage get it, then everybody's got it.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. And going back to the caterpillar to butterfly, there comes a point when, at first, the imaginal cells, the new butterfly cells that start popping up, are not, they're isolated. They don't survive. But at some point, there's enough of this new pattern, enough of these new cells that are popping up that they begin to communicate with one another, they begin to connect with one another, and at some point, there is that threshold moment where we're a butterfly now. And, of course, it doesn't go backwards. You know, the caterpillar doesn't go, I thought about changing to a butterfly, but I think I'm going to stay the way I am. No, that doesn't happen in nature. So what's happening right now is that the so-called cultural creatives, this is just the postulate, I'm just imagining this true, but I suspect I'm going in the right direction. These new human imaginal cells, the cultural creatives, are tuned into the signal of the healthy central voice from this new organism called humanity. Now, what's interesting about the caterpillar and the butterfly, this is a very important point, is that caterpillar and butterfly both have the same DNA. The difference is in the signal that they are receiving. So I would suspect that the people who are waking up to this notion of, I think we're all in this together, they are receiving a signal from this human, from the organism called humanity that doesn't exist yet in the physical, but exists in the field.
And it seems that that would also be connected to the awakening of the heart, and compassion and conscience, as well as consciousness.
Yeah, well said. That's exactly right. Because if we look at in the book, we go into a great deal of detail about this. We talk about the heart and the exciting discoveries that have been made via the HeartMath Institute. And essentially, the heart sends out waves. And depending on the coherence of these patterns, there is a direct correlation between the coherence of these heart wave patterns and the sense of peace and equanimity that people feel and the secretion of hormones that are beneficial, that make us feel happy and secure. So there's a direct relationship to the physical heart and the chemistry of the body that helps determine our mood. Now, there are certain techniques that the heart math people have developed which allow us to entrain our heart waves with a coherent pattern. And so we end up being more in touch, more intuitive, more peaceful. What's also interesting is that when people come into the same room, their heart rates tend to entrain just as a tuning forks would attune with one another. So we know now that the heart actually, the physical organ called the heart, actually is a way for people to connect with and relate to one another. We also talk about love, which of course it seems like it's a very etheric and intangible kind of concept. But love is a field of coherence, and we've all felt this kind of field of coherence when we've been in a harmonious situation, when we're in love with somebody else, when we are we're chanting together, if we're in a harmonious place with other people, this field of harmony actually can impact the world outside. There was a very interesting experiment done back in the 1990s by the people who do transcendental meditation. And they brought a group of meditators to Washington, D.C., and they figured out a threshold number. It was several hundred. And it was during the summer, which is when crime tends to go up. And they did these, they had the meditators in Washington, D.C. for a period of time, and something very surprising happened. The crime rate went down, as did the rates of people's visits to emergency rooms and so on. And the odds of that, the chances that this was something random was about a billion to one. So clearly there was some correlation between the field created by these meditators and the harmonious, the greater harmony and health in that community. There is also a book by Arjuna Arda called The Oneness Blessing. And it describes a similar experiment done in India, where this particular ashram was practicing this coherence meditation and blessing. And the villages surrounding that area showed a marked decrease in alcoholism and other outpicturings of dysfunctional behavior. So, you know, there may be, in fact, there probably very clearly is, a field of study, field of endeavor, that actually is looking at the relationship between waves of thought that pass, large numbers of people participate in, and the outpicturing of health, harmony, and coherence in that field.
Well, the what your description of the experiment to bring down crime would suggest that it only requires a small percentage of people to actually make the changes. So that could be similar to what you said about the new consciousness paradigm that's emerging at this time, which hasn't quite clicked in yet, it doesn't seem, that there is going to be a quantum leap, hopefully. And we might find out, like you said, with the butterfly, that we have wings and we can fly.
Yeah, and
of course, we might fall on our faces too. But you know what? I'd rather try and trip a few times than not try at all.
Yeah, and again, what you described earlier of, you know, if this is really happening, why are things so screwed up?
Thank you.
And getting more so every day. And it's
yes.
Because every institution, every field, everything that's built on something that's no longer true is getting, it's just kind of flying more and more and more out of coherence.
Right.
So that everybody gets the idea at once.
And it seems that there's, at some point there was some kind of rotten apple introduced into, and I'm not trying to make any references to Adam and Eve, but there was a rotten apple in the bunch, and it has pervaded literally the fabric of creation in a holographic manner, so that we have corruption at every level, from the top to the bottom and in between, and that certainly cannot sustain itself, as you said. It's like the snake eating its own tail. Sooner or later, you're going to end up with just a head. Talking head.
Well, I think we've swallowed a lot of tails, and most of the tails that we've swallowed no longer apply. They're not true tails. I think that if we look at this entire process as an evolutionary learning process that's necessary. Like, for example, let's take the fall from the garden, if we call that. We could look at that as the change of moving away from this indigenous idea of everything is related and everything is connected. If we look at that indigenous belief that there's no separation and so on, it's really it really paces the infant, where there is there's the connection to the mother. It's all very clear, but in order for us to get to the point where we are now, in order for growth to take place, there's a journey. You have to journey away from the safety of this protected state, and learn other things. So we have ventured. We ventured out from the garden, and now it seems that we have to regrow the garden ourselves, that this is the conscious evolution, is recognizing consciously who we are, rather than simply being, other little animals, and only human animals in a petting zoo. So everything that's happened in human history is part of our evolutionary experience, and all of it is necessary.
Well, it seems that it's kind of urgent now that people start to awaken to these truths, because we're literally running out of time. The hourglass has got maybe a grain or two of sand left in it. The oceans, I just found this out. I didn't even know this part. But they're just literally miles of islands of plastic floating around compacted in a mass in the oceans, and ships have to go make a long journey to get around it. You can't go through it. And then, you've got the dead zones in the oceans, which are expanding at an accelerating rate. And we probably are going to run out of food and water pretty soon if the corporations have anything to say about it. So it could be a rude awakening.
Well, yeah, and again, nothing is guaranteed. Just as the butterfly, the caterpillar, it's inevitable that the caterpillar becomes the butterfly, but it's not inevitable that humans evolve. This is part of this is a conscious participatory process. And that's really what this is about, and we have to participate. It's not something that is some deity coming down from the sky and making things perfect for us.
Right.
That might
right.
have been, that's kind of a very infantile way of looking at our destiny, and that's not what our destiny is.
Right, right. There seems to be also a lot of circuitry that's going on that kind of hampers our ability to think, such as all the microwaves and, of course, there's HARP and various other things, interference patterns that are kind of keeping us at a certain level of participation, like television and cell phones and so on and so forth. It seems like it's creating more chaos.
Well, you know, that may very well be true. If you imagine somebody from the 1600s showing up here and bringing their you know, 400 or 500-year-old sensibility with them, the smells, the sounds, and the sights would probably be overwhelming. That the kind of threshold of energetic that we take for granted because we've been able to adjust to it, let's say.
Right, right. Kind of like the frog boiling in the water.
Yeah, the proverbial boiling frogs in the water. That's what it is.
Yeah. Do you see then that you seem to hold a hopeful vision for our future? How can we begin to work with our own thoughts and beliefs in order to create that vision rather than to be subject to and a victim of what we see around us?
That's a really good question. That's a very helpful
question. I don't know where it came from.
Oh, it came from the boson. No, it's a very helpful question. And really, I think that the clues that we have, I mean, first of all, evolution is not a theory, it's a practice. Evolution is practical. So if we want to practice evolution, we want to bring this evolution about, we want to practice it. So we need to shift our focus away from the old story in trying to fix the caterpillar, in trying to remedy the things that can't work anymore. And we have to begin to focus our work and our play attention on building this new butterfly organism. So what does that look like? Well, first of all, from the spiritual standpoint, it looks like having a connection with whatever one would call the all there is, and that power of love that reminds us that we are bigger than our situation. When you're overwhelmed by circumstances, and it's easy for that to happen right now, then it feels like whatever it is that's overwhelming us is bigger than we are. So when we get that spiritual perspective, you know, when we get that internal connection, then we recognize that we are eternal beings, that, you know, it's so interesting when you begin to delve into quantum physics, you're entering the twilight zone because it's not the physical Newtonian world that we imagine the world to be. And in that world, there is no time. Everything exists right now. Well, if everything exists right now, then what is the meaning of death? It doesn't exist. It means that if we're here now, we're always here. Wherever here is, wherever now is.
Right.
So
right.
These concepts, you know, the physicist James Jeans, back in 1925, he said, you know, we've had this Newtonian view, Descartes and Newton, talking about the universe as a machine. And he said, it's more accurate to say that the universe is a thought.
Oh.
So here, I mean, what could be more simultaneously tangible and intangible than a thought?
Mm-hmm.
It's not physical. You can't hold it in your hand, and yet the thought, in many ways, determines the reality. Here's an example. Let's take somebody who is anorexic. When this individual looks into the mirror, regardless of what they really look like, their perceptions tell them that they're fat. And it's like having
right,
a distorted
right.
mirror. Okay, so based on this perception, they physically limit what they eat until their system can't sustain any longer. So based on that perception, the physicality follows the perception.
Well, gee, then I'm going to start thinking that I'm skinny.
There you go.
Really fat.
Think that you're skinny. And, you know, that's right. The Swami has invented something to help with weight loss. It's called eating glasses. So it magnifies everything by 30%. So It makes it seem like there's a lot more food on your plate with these eating glasses.
You know, that brings up the idea that humor is changes our state to a higher degree, and you must see this constantly. The people, you know, in your audiences when you're doing shows and things like that, you know, that you make people laugh and you make them think at the same time and feel things that maybe they haven't felt and get outside of themselves for a moment. Isn't laughter a higher state? Comedy,
well, yeah, because first of all, one thing that happens is laughter can heal, not just physically. And I think the physical part is very, very important because it actually changes our body chemistry for the better. So it improves immune function, lowers the blood pressure, causes us to breathe, adds circulation. So physically, laughter is beneficial. And you know what? Even if you don't feel like laughing or you don't feel like smiling, if you smile, if you simply turn the corners of your mouth upward in a smile, we call that the levitational pull. Even if you just do that, your body thinks that you're happy, and your body begins to produce happy chemicals, strange as it may seem. So the physical act of laughter or smiling actually changes perceptions. So we don't laugh because we don't smile because we're happy. We're happy because we smile. Okay.
Mm.
Number two, the power of humor can create emotional release and emotional healing as well. You know, you never know how you can change somebody's mood just by a joke, just by or even a playful gesture. Laughter dislodges mental structures that no longer work, that need to be deconstructed. That's one of the great things that humor does, is that it's a way for us to look at concepts, and we call it a weapon of mass deconstruction. It deconstructs old beliefs. And finally, humor gives us spiritual perspective. It gives us a God's eye view. It allows us to see from a higher view and reminds us that we are bigger than our situation. So, obviously, I recommend humor. And as a matter of fact, I've got a very, in addition to the Spontaneous Evolution book available on my website, wakeuplaughing.com, there's also an ebook called Wake Up Laughing, An Insider's Guide to the Cosmic Comedy. And we have they're normally $15. We have a special going on as of this afternoon. It'll be $10. So until May 2nd, which is World Laughter Day. So we want to actually enhance the laugh force and generate this laugh force for the next 2 weeks or so. And maybe we can create a force field big enough to heal the hole in the boson layer.
Well, you know, that sounds like a wonderful idea. And what you're suggesting then is that resistance is futile, and that all of these attempts that we see going on to resist the way things are and to change this and change that really aren't going to change anything. It's kind of a process that's evolving towards realizing that the change is within, and at least until the economy runs out, and then there won't be any change.
Well, you know, yes, everybody's calling out for change. Spare change, spare change, spare change. I think that not to misinterpret that, this is, you know, it's not like a call to be passive. It's a call to, rather than resisting and fighting against something that you don't want, simply asking the question, what would I like instead, and beginning to build that. Because that represents living into the new story. That represents building the butterfly. And if you think about how much resistance we spend arguing and fighting and complaining. You know, as somebody pointed out, Martin Luther King did not give a speech called "I Have a Complaint."
True, true.
It's much more compelling and useful to to build forward to what you want. And because, again, I think that one of the reasons why things have not shifted more quickly is the amount of energy that people are spending being pulled into talking about or fighting about what they don't want. Because the
right.
real question is, what would you like instead? What could we be doing instead? If there's no
right.
alternative to what we're doing now, you know, then, you know, buy a beer, get some bonbons, and watch TV. You know, that makes as much sense as anything else.
Well, you know, it takes effort to actually envision or create a vision, which I think you called that imagineering, the butterfly, when the butterfly, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
They're
well,
imaginal.
Television, you know, we have a vision, we tell our vision, we tell our vision to each other, and then we have healing and functional visions to step into, and it beats what we've been stepping into, if you know what I mean.
Yes. You had an interesting solution to our economic problems, which is presented by Stephen Zerlinga. I thought that was kind of a creative way to approach things. Do you remember that those three steps in his plan?
Well, I think let me back up a little bit.
Okay.
When we looked at what do we do instead? Where do we go to get advice? What's working? And where we went to get advice was the body. What is the body doing? And we looked at the economic system of the body, because after all, economics is merely how energy gets produced, stored, moved around, distributed. And if we look at money as representing ability to do work, ability to accomplish things, ability to produce, it simply represents energy. So we look at the current economic system, and particularly in the light of what happened, what's happened in the last year and a half, which is that the House of Credit Cards economy has crumbled to the ground. And, you know, you had these companies that were leveraged by a factor of 35, that they had loaned out 35 times more than they had on hand. How inconvenient. So what we're recognizing is that the real economy is based on how we use available energy, how we conserve available energy. So in the body, there's no borrowing. You can't, put your energy on put it on your ascended MasterCard and pay for it next lifetime. You can't do that. So we're dealing only with available energy. And so the way the energy is moved around and stored in the body is through ATP, which is a phosphate that is either when you add on phosphate molecules. Let me back up. Without getting into the explanation, it's a way that energy is moved and stored in the body. Energy is in the system. Every cell gets what it needs to thrive in the human body. It has universal health care. There's full employment. There's no cell left behind. But those cells that are doing the most essential jobs get more resource to do those cells, do those jobs. But the resource is distributed on the basis of contribution to the well-being of the whole system, because every cell benefits from the whole system. In citing the work of Stephen Zerlinga at the American Monetary Institute, he's done some really brilliant research on the Federal Reserve System, on how we can be issuing money as simply representation for the goods produced and not as debt, because right now money is created by the Federal Reserve and it enters the system as debt, so that the more money that goes into the system, the less each dollar is worth. It waters down the value of the money that's in the system. And then at some point, the money of, well, right now the dollar is worth, I think, slightly less than the dollar in monopoly money. So the solution that the American Monetary Institute offers, and it's the same thing that the Chicago Plan, which was essentially formulated by the leading economists in the 1930s, but nixed by the banking industry, it's essentially that when we don't issue money as debt, but when we have the money simply as a representation of the actual value that's in the economy, then we have a system where the value remains the same, the money doesn't get watered down, and we don't get enslaved by metastasizing debt like we have right now. The one thing that the Tea Party people and the conservatives have right is that it's not possible under any circumstances, it's not mathematically possible to repay the national debt ever. So it is this constant, ongoing, incurable. It's an incurable disease that takes all of the energy, all of the real wealth out of the system. And so, we're at a point, just as everything else is changing, we're at a point where our economics is changing to where we have to consider how we represent the real value in the economy. And the real value can be boiled down to this. The food that we grow, the energy from the sun, which is for our purposes infinite, we may as well call it infinite. It is the love that we have, because the love is something that makes life better. It creates beauty. It creates connection between people. And the and our imagination, which is what enables us to create inventions that save us time and energy. That's what the real economy is. And if it's not one of those things, if it's not how do we grow food, how do we harness energy, how do we make life more comfortable, more beautiful, more happy, and how do we use our technology to become even more efficient for the benefit of the commonwealth, not just the uncommonly wealthy.
Right. Well, it's clear from everything that you said and from your wonderful book that we certainly are poised on the verge of some major shifts and changes. I didn't get a chance to ask you if you felt there was any parallel between any of the various prophecies that are floating around out there, like the Mayans and so on and so forth, but maybe we can get into another conversation.
The Swami is writing a book called 2012, The Secrets Revealed.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, the book's going to be out in 2013.
All right, wonderful. Well, I want to save a few moments at the end of the show to ask you where, if you're going to be doing any book signings, where you'll be. Are you going to have some stand-up comedy pretty soon, and where that will that be, and how can people find you on your website?
Okay, let's go to the website first. It's wakeuplaughing.com, wakeuplaughing.com. Lots of fun stuff on there. In upcoming weeks, on Friday, April 23rd, I'll be in Fairfield, California. That's not far from Sacramento. And then in May, the early part of May, the first weekend in May, I'm doing a tour of the Northwest. We'll be in Port Townsend, Washington, Seattle, Portland, Oregon, Ashland, Oregon, and Yuba City, California.
Wow.
And then in June, we're going to be at the, we're going to be in Santa Fe in Albuquerque. We're going to be at the Harmony Fair in Santa Rosa, California. We're going to be at the Golden Gate Church in, San Rafael, California. Probably, I think we're doing something else in Santa Rosa. So to find out, just go to wakeuplaughing.com. We have a calendar of events. And if you want to bring the Swami to your hometown, we can do that. The Swami has turban, will travel. So he's turban power. He puts the turban on, and that's his power.
What about that body scanner at the airport?
I don't have my body scanned. That's why I totally fly by carpet. So Swami is on the air now, but he's in the air quite a bit, too.
Well, you can imagine.
Yeah.
Do you meditate and do all those things that people talk about?
I pre-meditate. I don't need to. I'm meditating tomorrow. So I'm
pre-meditating.
Premeditated meditation. You know, you don't need to meditate. All you need to do is a simple practice to dislodge all of the unnecessary thoughts in your head, which can cause a condition called truth decay. What you need to do is use mental floss every day, just back and forth, your hand by one ear, your hand by the other, you move it back and forth, and you will dislodge all of the illogical logic.
Wonderful. Well, Steve Swami, I just want to thank you for being on the show. You're absolutely wonderful. I can't thank you enough, and for sharing all your wisdom and insights and humor and everything else. And I certainly wish you the best on this wonderful book. I'll have a chance to talk to Bruce in a few weeks, so I'll get his version of the book.
Oh, good, yes. Well, that'll be fun also. And keep up the zany mysticism.
All right.
And I appreciate your work as well, and may the farce be with us all.
Wonderful. Thanks again, Steve.
Okay.
And good luck on your tours and books and everything else.
And thank you. Hope to catch you on the fun way.
Yes. All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And that's Zany Mystic over and out for now. Bye-bye.